The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston, broadcasting to seven continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good morning, listeners. Welcome to the Friday morning California time space shell program. I'm your host, David Livingston. Thank you very much for tuning in. A couple of very quick announcements. Today's program is on our full 90-minute segment, but still, watch the clock. Make sure that if you want to get an email in or a phone call in to our guest today, you do so while we're still on the air. And we appreciate doing that. And again, we're on the 90-minute format today. We have a full program on Sunday with Jeffrey of Future Dude Film Productions with his new science fiction space films that are coming out soon. And Dr. Jim Logan will be here Tuesday evening. So the schedule is already up on the website, and also you can see the schedule on the website newsletter if you just scroll down. So for today, our toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. We prefer phone calls over emails. It is a talk show, so that generally implies that we like to talk. So again, let me give out that toll-free number, 866-687-7223. You can still use email, drspace@thespaceshow.com. And you can also post comments on our blog. To do that, go to our website, thespaceshow.com, all the way to the far right for the upcoming show menu. Click on the first show, which features today's guest, Morgan Irons. And if you open that page and go all the way down to the bottom, you can post comments and ask questions. As soon as you hit the send button, I'll get a copy of it and can bring it up on air. So those are the three ways you can communicate with us. But once again, we do prefer and push for the toll-free line and for actual conversation with you, 866-687-7223. Note that our website newsletter is posted on our website. It's over on the upper right. That's going to be updated on Sunday after the Sunday Space Show. But it is complete for what's happening this week. But also, all of our shows for 2019 are booked. And if you scroll down a little bit on that website newsletter, you'll see who's planned for the rest of the year and going into the month of January. Everything we do is archived. So you can listen right off of our website or rapidly download the programs to listen to them on your own device. The file sizes are not that big, so you can easily do it if you have a good internet connection in just a minute or two. We do have a store. It's gift-giving time with the Christmas season right around the corner. So if you're interested in Space Show logo wear for your favorite Space Show listener or space enthusiast, you might find some things at our store. To get there, click on any of the website pictures of Pepper listening to the Space Show, and she will take you to our Cafe Press Space Show logo wear store. And again, hopefully you'll find some items of interest. And your feedback, of course, is always, always welcome. And then there's a Listen Live button up on that upper left menu. This tells you how to listen to the live broadcast, which is what we're doing right now. And then it tells you also how to listen to archives that are posted on the M-site, the website, excuse me. Those are compressed MP3s, and then how to listen to podcasts. And we're in quite a few podcast directories, iTunes, iHeartRadio, TuneIn. All of the Android podcast apps should carry the Space Show, as well as Apple Podcast and apps on the iOS system. So when searching for us, the full name of the show is what you search for, which is the, T-H-E, space show. So don't search for us without using T-H-E, because that's not part of our name, and you'll get something else. If you have any podcasting questions, please do get a hold of me and let me know, Dr. Space, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. And then do remember, we're in our annual campaign drive to fund the Space Show going into 2020. We're a listener-funded program, and that means that you, the listener, support us, and we produce the Space Show. We're also a nonprofit, 501c3. Our parent is One Giant Leap Foundation. We are, in addition to the 501c3, a California Public Benefit Corporation, so you get tax deductions from your taxes if you pay federal taxes and if you pay California taxes. We partner with you, and we need your support and help for funding for the new year and to reach our goals for operating expenses and to update our analog telephone hybrid equipment. So please support us. We have about 2.5 weeks left of the year, and if the tax deduction angle is important to you, you have to do it in 2019 to get the deductions for 2019. So we do thank all of you who have supported us, those of you who will support us, and we look forward to answering any questions you might have. But again, your support is really crucial, and we thank you for donating. And then one other thing, we do have sponsors, and as this is a full 90-minute program, I'm going to thank our sponsors and read their messages during the break between segments 1 and 2. So stay tuned for that. We are also opening up for sponsors for 2020. And that brings me to our guest today, so I'm very happy to welcome for the very first time on the Space Show, Morgan Irons. Ms. Irons is an ecologist and an environmental scientist. Her research is focused on understanding and applying ecological theories and principles to develop and manage quasi-closed agro-ecological systems for use in extreme and changing Earth and space environments. Morgan and the DSE science team seek to understand how biochemical cycles and feedbacks can be developed in a sterilized, degraded soil or regolith condition through conducting fundamental research in field applications. She's a PhD candidate in the fields of soil and crop science at Cornell University. And she has also, and we congratulate her for this, been honored and awarded with the American Society for Gravitational and Space Research's Ken Souza Memorial Spaceflight Award. So congratulations to you for that very prestigious award. Morgan, welcome to the Space Show. How are you today?
I'm doing well. Thank you for having me, Dr. Livingston.
So please say David, okay?
Okay.
Until you get mad during the show, then anything goes.
Got it.
I learned about you because of the people who attended the Space Studies Space Settlement Conference on, I guess it was September 9th and 10th of this year in Seattle. And when they did the post-SSI Space Show program, your presentation stood out along with just a couple of others, and you were suggested for being on the Space Show. So that's how I found out about you. And I have listened to your presentation on the panel on the SSI program. Listeners, I will put the link up to her panel presentation in the summary of this show. Plus, you sent a great amount of detail to us. I hope listeners got a chance to look at it or will. It's on the blog already, listeners, with lots of links to important information about Morgan and her research and the subject matter. But this is kind of a strange field. You know, lately I've been hearing more about it, but for almost 19 years I haven't heard very much about it at all. So how did you get into space agriculture? I know from your presentation at SSI, you have a big focus on soil. I haven't done many programs on soil and space at all. Tell us how you got from wherever you started to where you are today.
Yeah, so it's a very interesting story, but I feel like it's also a common story, especially with young students who are trying to figure out what they want to do with their education and their career path. So I did my undergraduate at Duke University in Durham, North Carolina, and I actually entered Duke wanting to go to medical school and become an orthopedic surgeon. But underlying that thought and that idea and that goal that I had developed were these two passions that have been with me my entire life. And those are just a passion for the environment and understanding how environmental systems work, as well as with space exploration and wondering, is there life outside of Earth? Is there life in our solar system or out in the universe? And so while I was at Duke, I realized that those two passions of mine for environmental science and space exploration were ultimately what I ended up wanting to do for my life. But I wasn't sure how to combine those two together. It didn't seem really practical to figure out how to combine those two because I'd never heard of that in the space industry. When you think about the space industry, you think about the heavy engineering, rockets, rovers, landers, things like that. You don't really think about plants and agriculture. And so in my sophomore year at Duke, I pretty much sat down and decided that I needed to figure out how to combine these two things together. And so that winter, that's what I did with the help of my father, who was a big support during that time. And I found this research report from the 1960s from the Soviet Union, in which they had been doing research on closed ecological system research for space habitation. And the more I read about closed ecological systems, the more I realized that this is where I could combine my passions together, understanding how we could create habitation systems that support an agricultural system. And so pretty much that's where this all began. And no one at Duke was performing space research, so I had to cold call a few graduate professors and ask them, hey, you're a specialist in soil scientist or in systems ecology. How would you like to put a space twist on what you're doing? And thankfully, I had the support of three wonderful graduate professors, Dr. Dan Richter, Dr. Jim Heffernan, and Dr. Justin Wright, who supported me and mentored me in the creation of this research on closed ecological systems and space agriculture. And with this research, I was pretty much taking what we know here on Earth, the ecological theories and principles of how we understand how ecosystems work here on Earth, and asking the questions of how would these change or how would these stay the same if we put it into a space environment. And so a lot of it was exploratory, independent study, doing my own research, and that eventually led to me doing this large-scale Mars agricultural experiment at Duke using Mars regolith simulant to understand soil biogeochemistry dynamics and how we can go from this degraded regolith or Martian soil to a healthy, quote-unquote healthy soil that could support an agricultural system. And so based on that research, I eventually founded the company Deep Space Ecology, which works to solve the challenges of food security and the problems of human sustainability in the deep spaces of Earth, the Moon, and Mars, and beyond, really. And so from all of this, I graduated from Duke, and now I am a PhD student at Cornell University in the field of soil and crop sciences, where I'm continuing to study soil biogeochemistry and how we can take degraded soils here on Earth, as well as the geological substrates that we would find in space, and revitalize them for agricultural use.
Do you have a dissertation topic? Is that it? or you have yet to decide that?
Yeah, I'm currently in the process of finalizing all of those details. And, of course, with a PhD, you get very, very specific. So with my PhD, what it currently looks like I'm going to be doing for my dissertation is looking at the organo-mineral interface in soil. So where organic, soil organic matter, microorganisms interact with soil minerals, and looking at that molecular level to understand the chemistry of what's happening there. Because a current question and challenge that we have here on Earth is understanding how soil organic matter is stabilized in the soil and how it persists over time. Because having organic matter in the soil is very important for fertility, having that nutrient source, and having a soil that is able to support a biodiversity of microorganisms and plants.
So I need to get a definition from you.
Yes.
So when we talk about life support for long duration space, deep space, we're usually talking about closed loop. And then the terminology in the bio that I read, you're talking about quasi closed. So what's the difference between quasi and closed? I mean, I know the English language difference, but what's missing, and why is it quasi, and why not fully closed?
Yeah, so the reason why I developed a new terminology for that, going from a closed ecological system to what I term a quasi-closed agroecological system, is this idea of using the in-situ resources of an area. And when I say in-situ resources, I mean whatever resources that are in that area that you're creating your habitation system. So, for example, for Mars, what would be the resources that we could use in that area to bring into our system? And one of the resources is the Martian regolith, how we can take that regolith into our system and actually use it as the beginning substrate to eventually support an agroecological system. So with a closed system, it's this idea that you completely shut off the system from its surroundings and have all of the cycling and feedback within the system. And so I wanted to bring in this quasi-closed idea so that we could take into account that we're probably going to be taking resources from our surroundings outside of our system to support the system.
So if we were doing this on the moon, I mean, the lunar regolith is pretty different than Mars. So
yes, it
would it still be quasi, or would the moon end up being completely closed?
That's a good question. I'd probably say that it would be more closed. And so that gets into a great thing to consider, is that these systems that we develop will be very much situational based, very much determinant on their environment for how we build the system and the system requirements.
So, and if you're on a long mission to Mars, there's not going to be anything in situ in transit, I'm assuming. Maybe I'm wrong on that. So in transit, your system is closed. So at some point, you have to go from closed to quasi and open it up somehow. Is that a fair understanding?
Yeah, and you'll probably have different systems throughout your journey. So on your spacecraft, it might be more of a hydroponic system that you're using to supplement or support your agricultural system. While when you get to the moon, maybe you've had rovers and other robotics sent previously to start building your system and start your agricultural system, so that when you get to Mars, you have something there already. And maybe at the very beginning, you start off with this integrated system where a lot of your food supplementing is coming from a hydroponics or an aquaponics system, while your field agricultural system is being developed and growing. And so the way that I view it is that this is probably going to be an integrated system where you have hydroponics as well as a field-based system. And I know that's been a very interesting point of discussion in the space industry, where there are people who are like, we are just going to be using a hydroponic system, and that's going to, hydroponics, aquaponics, or aeroponic system, and that's going to be able to support our entire agricultural system. But I believe we need more of an integrated system where we have that hydroponics element as well as a field-based system.
Okay, so I'm jumping forward probably over a lot of details that we can come back and cover. But so let me get a dose of realism here. So, well, so first of all, I'm not a scientist or an engineer, so my background is in the business world, and my degrees, including my doctorate, are in economics and finance and management and marketing. So I'm saying, okay, so realistically, you've got people talking about getting hundreds, if not thousands, of people to Mars, for example. And we'll use Mars as an example. What does it take to secure a food supply? And the reason I'm choosing Mars is because you're likely not going to resupply it from Earth very easily, whereas the moon, mm-hmm. you could possibly, if you threw away the cost, resupply from Earth. But it's unlikely that you're going to resupply food supplies for a settlement of some sort on Mars. So it's going to have to be self-sustaining, either with enormous numbers of supplies that have been taken on board or doing something like you're talking about on Mars. So for every, what does it take to secure a food supply for 100 Martian settlers that are not going to get resupplied from Earth? I'll just leave it at 100 people. What are we looking at to supply that in terms of how much space do hydroponics need? What is needed to pull that off, and could we do that today?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a very complicated question, and it actually has a lot of calculations that have to be made to figure out what those specific numbers would be. But when you're considering supporting any number of people, you have to consider that these people are most likely going to be an international crew, and they're going to be coming from different food cultures and potentially have different food restrictions, so you have to take that into account. You have to really consider, when you're thinking about this question of life support and space habitation and space agriculture, that it's not just the plants, but you also have humans that are part of the ecosystem. You have the tools that they use that can manage or alter your ecosystem. So you have to consider that to support any number of people, that you're going to need a biodiversity of plant species. And what I mean by biodiversity is just not just having a field of corn, but you also have beans, squash, a variety of different plant species that are able to have this multifunctionality. And so with multifunctionality and biodiversity, you're not only having this variety of plants used as a food source, but you also have to have plants that provide multiple functions. So you could have a plant like French sorrel that can act as a lettuce. You can eat it as a lettuce, but it also has medicinal properties where you can use it to treat upper respiratory infections. And then you have legume plants that, again, you can use as a food source, but they also interact with rhizobium bacteria in the soil to help fix nitrogen into a bioavailable form that plants can then take up so that they can have their nitrogen source. And so you have to consider, to be able to support a group of people, you have to create an ecosystem that is stable and resilient and can provide multiple functions beyond just being a food source. And the terminology that's commonly used to describe what I've been talking about is you have to consider the ecological services that your system provide. So these ecological services include provisioning services, which include food, water, fuel, medicine, materials to build with, stuff like that. And then you have regulating services, which can include the pollination of plants, decomposition, the carbon storage in the soil, climate regulation, even water purification. And then cultural services. Are people going to be able to use your system for recreation? Do they have a spiritual element? Or is there a way to promote food culture with your system? And then the last ecological service to consider is the supporting service. And this goes into really understanding how an ecosystem functions and goes through ecological succession over time. So how is soil created? Do you have a biodiversity of plant species and a biodiversity of genetics? What's the biogeochemical cycling in the soil like? Things like that. And so that's a bit of the nitty-gritty detail when it comes to things we need to consider for any size of agricultural system to support any size of people. When it comes to actual dimensions of how large is this system actually going to be, that's where it also gets a bit more complicated because you have to consider the technology that you are also using. So is your agricultural system, your agroecological system, going to provide you with an oxygen source, or are you going to have technology in place to help supplement that or provide the oxygen source that you need? So that can change your space dimensions of what you're using to rely on as a resource for a particular outcome. It's a complicated question, and you have to consider the food and nutritional needs of people. And I guess that ultimately your question that you asked, ultimately you have to consider what about the system makes it a food secure system.
So what's our technological readiness level to do this today? Are we perfectly capable of doing this today if we could get to Mars with 100 people? Or is this going to take some time to evolve into?
I think it's going to take some time to evolve into, and definitely a promotion of multidisciplinary collaboration, because there is technology out there that is currently being used in, i.e., the agricultural industry, that could be spun into space applications, but there's no communication that's happening between the industries or these disciplines. I know that in the agricultural industry right now, there's this huge movement towards digital agriculture, where you use technology and sensors to see, like, when a plant is under nutrient stress, or even have a robot go through the field that can use sensors to see if a fruit is ripe enough and then pick it itself. And so there's this movement in the agricultural industry to better use technology to help manage the system and prevent disease or pest problems. But we haven't really seen communication with the space industry and vice versa about how we can use that technology in space, because that would be technology that I could see being used in a habitation system on Mars, especially when you're talking about how work-intensive a field-based system can be. And if you can have some technology there to help you monitor it, as well as even help in the harvest and planting of your system, then all the better. The people who go up could spend more time working on the science and the exploration. So, yeah, there's definitely a need for more conversations to happen.
So, Morgan, I hear, and maybe you do too, that we're going to be going to Mars in 10 years with X number of people on Starship or whatever. I never hear the companies talk about life support, and boy, I never ever hear them talk about even 10% of what you're talking about. So I have to ask you, I guess this is going to be an opinion on your part, and if you don't want to express it, I certainly understand why. But it sounds to me like the people promoting this either are ignorant of what you're talking about and have no clue about what it's going to take to sustain 100 people or more or a little bit less on Mars, or maybe they're doing something in secret to work all of this out and they're not ready to divulge it to the public mm-hmm. yet. Or the public is being led on and enthused about something that in reality isn't going to happen, certainly not on any kind of a timetable that we're being told is likely to happen. Are we sort of being misled and shined on and getting excited about something that may be decades away, given what I see as a lack of real progress? And maybe agriculture is making progress, but as you said, there's certainly no progress in communicating with one another from the space industry to mm-hmm. other disciplines. Are we being shined on?
It's hard to say, and I can't really comment on that because, like you said, that people could be working on it and they just haven't published it or talked about it, or it's currently under closed off from the public eye because of business related restrictions. So it's hard to say, but I would definitely put out a call to action that we need to talk about the subject more, and that we need to bring in people from different disciplines. We need to bring in the nutritionists. We need to bring in different medical doctors. We need to bring in soil scientists and ecologists and microbiologists that can look at the problem in a different viewpoint. And that's something that I really have grown to appreciate in my academic journey, is just having a diversity of people from different life experiences, different academic backgrounds, different industries, just having them all in a room to think about this question and have their viewpoint. I think that's something that needs to be promoted more in the space industry, especially when it comes to this topic, because if you really look at the history of closed ecological system research for space habitation, a lot of the conversations have been dominated by engineers. And I'm not saying that to blast engineers or anything, because the engineering is vital to make this happen. But we also need to understand how we would take degraded soil and revitalize it for agricultural use, how having these plants in the system may affect the atmosphere, which then may affect the types of materials that you are using. Is there going to be oxidation happening? What's the chemistry involved in all of these interactions happening in the system? And I think, just to bring up an example of how important this is, Biosphere 2 is such a great example of the need to better understand the natural component of the system, as well as understand how the natural system and the technological system can interact together. Because one of the issues that Biosphere 2 had is that the cement that they used was actually affecting the atmospherics in the system, and the atmospherics of the system were also being affected by the microorganisms in the soil decomposing all of this organic matter that had been introduced into the system. So I think it's just a continued call to action that, like, we need to promote these conversations, and we need to welcome people from a diversity of people and a diversity of ideas into this realm so that we can actually start really making some progress and having it show in publicly accessible papers, and even when businesses finally show what they've been working on, showing that these ideas that they've come up with are actually sound because they've had the experts from these different fields working on the project with them.
Your first email comes from Claire in New Orleans, and she said NASA is known for doing lots of work on astronaut nutrition.
Mm-hmm.
People have written books on it. David has had guests on talking about nutrition, but that just seems to be one small part of what you're talking about, plus the fact their nutrition is for the space station for the most part. Is NASA engaging in the kind of complicated and multidisciplined research that you're talking about, or are they limited to what they do with nutrition for astronauts in low Earth orbit?
That is a great question. I'm actually very very good friends with the food team down at NASA Kennedy Space Center. And so I've been down there a few times and talked with them and had these conversations with them. And currently, like you said, a lot of their research is focused on the International Space Station, and in particular on this idea of supplementing prepackaged foods on the International Space Station. So we know that the astronauts and cosmonauts have these prepackaged foods that they are living off of, but then you have the veggie system on the ISS that is able to grow some lettuce and some different dwarf species that can fit in that space, and then the astronauts can use that to supplement their diet, which goes into having more nutrition as well as to prevent this problem of menu fatigue, where you don't want your crew to be eating the same thing every day, every week, which can actually lead to them not wanting to eat anymore. And this is called menu fatigue. And so if you can have a way to supplement their diet with these plants that provide a burst of flavor and have good nutrition, then it can prevent this menu fatigue from happening. And currently, that's really the focus of what NASA has them doing right now. But they are very much knowledgeable about this need to go beyond that with understanding soil science and understanding system dynamics, and eventually having a full-on agricultural system. They are very much aware of this. And it can be a little bit difficult when your funding is dependent on the government. So that's why NASA sends out these calls for proposals, these RFPs, requests for proposals. Like the current RFP that's out, I believe, what is it called? It's the ROS Bio. It's like research opportunities for outer space biology research, something like that. I apologize if I said that wrong, but it's ROS Bio. It's this current RFP that's been out, that NASA has put out, and they're seeking researchers and people who are interested in these topics that can push forward the research when the researchers at NASA have to focus on the particular point in time that they are at with their research. So there is definitely a promotion of multidisciplinary research happening, but it's mostly being put out to the public and to academics and to private industry and the like.
I told you when we were setting up for the show that I recently had Bryce Meyer on the program.
Yes.
And I mentioned that you were coming on the program, so he had some questions for you.
Thanks.
So, if you know Bryce, he's got a particular bent, from what I can tell, in a certain area. But one of his questions was, how do you turn regolith into soil? And you've been talking about degraded soil. I'm adding to Bryce's question, is regolith degraded soil? Or what do you mean? Maybe we do definitions again by degraded soil. You're not taking bags of dirt from earth like potting soil up to space, or are you?
Yeah, so I guess the way to start off that question is to understand what the difference is between regolith and soil. So regolith can be found on Earth as well as on the Moon, on Mars, some asteroids, and other terrestrial bodies. And pretty much regolith is this unconsolidated material and weathered rock that you find on top of the bedrock of a planet or a terrestrial body. What I mean by degraded is pretty much its ability to support life, whether it's microorganisms, the small species that you find in soils like nematodes and other such fauna, as well as plant species. So that's what I really mean by degraded, is its ability to support life. And the definition of soil, which I actually have right here, because our definition of soil that we use comes from the Soil Science Society of America, and they currently changed their definition of soil in 2017. And so the definition that they currently have for soil is, to quote them, the Soil Science Society of America, the layers of generally loose mineral and or organic material that are affected by physical, chemical, and or biological processes at or near the planetary surface and usually hold liquid gases and biota and support plants. And so their new definition added that planetary portion to it. So there is a bit of a movement in the soil science realm to consider if there are soils outside of Earth. So I found that to be pretty cool when they changed the definition to include planetary. So pretty much when we're talking about soil, we're talking about geological material that has biologics in it that can support plants, that is affected by physical, chemical, and biological processes, things like that, versus regolith that is more of that weathered rock closer to mineral, so, more mineral-based.
So is there soil on the Moon or Mars, or is it 100% regolith?
So I would call it regolith. Just based off of the definition that soil is something that that more likely has biologics in it. And we're not really sure right now whether the regolith on the Moon or Mars has biologics in it. Maybe, like, we may eventually find that there are microorganisms living in the regolith on Mars, which would be great. So it's actually a bit wishy-washy, I would say, whether we can classify the Martian regolith as a soil. I really think it really just comes down to the nitty-gritty of what you consider a soil. And there's even, like, arguments in the soil science field about what the definition of soil should be, because we have soils here on Earth that are in the desert, and you see there's really nothing growing there, but it's still considered a soil. So it can be a bit complicated in the soil science realm about definitions and such.
Okay, so now take us back to the first question of two questions from Bryce Meyer.
Yes.
How do you turn regolith into soil?
Yeah, so this is a theory that you can look at to help answer this question is this theory of ecological succession, which is pretty much understanding how ecological systems go from bare rock to a community that can support a biodiversity of species. And so in this theory, pretty much the ecosystems that we've seen around us, that we see around us, at some point in time started off as bare rock. And so when we look at this, we have to think, okay, how were biologics, how were plants and microorganisms and the like introduced into this system? And these species are commonly known as the pioneer species, the species that can survive in that harsh environment. And this tends to be different kinds of lichen and mosses and things like that, stuff that can grow on rocks and start breaking down the rock and putting nutrients into the environment through eventually being turned over in the soil. And you're also getting nutrients from that breakdown of that rock as well. And then you eventually start having the small annual plants coming in as well, and the introduction of microorganisms and the like. So you start to see this progression of different species coming in that are adaptable to that kind of harsher environment and start preparing the soil for the eventual introduction of grasses and then shrubs and trees and the like. So that's what ecological succession is about that process of bringing species in. When it comes really down to the nitty gritty, looking at an expedited ecological succession, because normally it takes hundreds of years for an ecological system to form from bare rock. So if we're looking at having a system on Mars, we have to expedite that process. So what you need to consider when you're looking at your initial degraded regolith condition is what makes up a soil that can support an agricultural system. So you have to have a biodiversity of microorganisms, and specifically microorganisms that provide a support to the plants that you're bringing in. So a microorganism that is commonly talked about, especially when it comes to association with plants, is the rhizobium bacteria, which can be either found free-floating in the bulk soil or can be found growing in nodules on the roots of legume plants. And those are different genus species of the rhizobia. And so you have to think about the microorganisms. And then you have to think about, like, for the microorganisms to survive, they also need a carbon source and organic and nutrients in the soil. So how can you really start forming these biogeochemistry cycles, the nitrogen cycle, the carbon cycle, oxygen exchange, things like that, the water cycle. So there's definitely a lot of research that's currently being done to understand more of the nitty-gritty details of these cycles and how they form and are affected as a soil changes over time. So you have to consider those biogeochemical cycles and how you could initially start those like I said, the microorganisms that play an important part in a lot of those cycles as well. And the introduction of that initial organic matter to the soil that can allow for the buildup of your soil organic matter. And that can be, when you're starting off with bare rocks, you follow that ecological succession theory of you start off with the lichens and you start off with weeds and stuff like that, because we see weeds growing out of cement, and it's like, wow, that species can survive in that harsh environment. So you start off with those kinds of species that can survive in that kind of environment, and then you can start to till them under the soil so that you can have those microorganisms start to break that down and add nutrients to the soil, as well as lead to these reservoirs of organic matter in the soil. And this is where a lot of my research is based. Like I said, I'm looking at these organo-mineral interactions for my PhD.
So here's what I'm hearing. Again, remember, I come from outside the industry, and you're my you're my professor. Actually, you're my first professor on this. So I'm hearing that to make regolith turn into living soil, there's a lot of theory and a lot of concept and idea of what goes into it, but that it's not been done, and that it's probably complicated, and it's going to involve a lot of research, and we're not, it's not prime time yet. Is that a summary?
Yeah, that's definitely part of the situation, is that nobody's really looked at this question until very, very recently. I started looking at this question as an undergraduate with my research, but it's really what's happening here on Earth that is driving a lot of these questions. So one of the reasons why this question of how can we revitalize degraded soils is becoming more prominent in the research sphere and in the literature is we have desertification happening across the world, in California, in the Midwest, in China, where these areas that could support agriculture or support forests and ecosystems at one time are now being turned into deserts. And this could be just because of how humans have treated the environment using unsustainable practices for so long. It could also be due to the changing climate and how that affects what species can grow in that area. And so there's this movement towards trying to reclaim these areas. How can we take these areas that used to be able to support an agricultural system or an ecological system and bring it back to a revitalized state? So there's so much research that's happening here on Earth that can feed into how we can approach this question for how we would do this on Mars. And I think that's something that's really important to keep in mind, that work that's being done here on Earth to help Earth systems can help us for space exploration. And the research that we're doing for space exploration can help back here on Earth and help inform the research here on Earth. So I'm completely in support of having this multidisciplinary research and this feedback going between industries so that we can support each other and ultimately work to conserve and restore ecological systems here on Earth, as well as when we go into space and form these habitation systems on other planetary terrestrial bodies, that we do so in a sustainable way so that we don't repeat the same problems that we've had here on Earth.
So we're over the midway point, and I'm going to take a break to thank our sponsors and read our sponsor messages. And you can go drink your herbal Lunar Regolith Revitalized Tea Leaves while we're on break, and then you can tell us what it's like. But listeners, we do have sponsors, and we would not be doing the space show without their great support and great help. So not only do I want to thank them, Northrop Grumman says that they're a leading global security company providing innovative systems, products, and solutions for both the government and commercial customers. And they do this globally, and they have capabilities from undersea to outer space and cyberspace. The Space Foundation sponsors us. They have their 36th symposium coming up, and this is where the world and space connect. It's March 30th to April 2nd. Colorado Springs, Colorado, spacesymposium.org for all of the detail. Asterix is our newest sponsor. Asterix Corporation has been involved in hypersonics and space plane reusable rocket designs with the Air Force, DARPA, and NASA for more than three decades. Their proprietary codes of HiSight and SpaceSight create and analyze these designs. Please view www.asterix.com for more information. AIAA sponsors us. This is the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics. It is the world's largest aerospace professional society. And they do five big events a year, but they have lots of smaller regional breakfast, luncheon, dinner meetings around the country. And they have a database of peer-reviewed papers going back decades. There's lots of benefits for being a member and great networking. So check them out at AIAA.org. Also, Moonward sponsors this. What if a group of nations was determined to build a town on the moon and they based their decision only on technical and economic merit? Moonwards is building a digital vision of that town where you will learn to play, build, and go to different events. Visit Moonwards.com to download an early draft demo of the town and to fund its development by subscribing. Help us help the world see a bigger future where we can leave our past behind us. And the Space Development Network sponsors us. They have a brand new message for all of you. This is a free organization to join, and it's full of space advocates just like you. Check out their website, developspace.info. The website is extensive and covers hardware, habitats, international exploration, Earth independence, settlement, policy, and more. Check it out and see if this is a network you want to get involved with. And again, the website is developspace.info. Also, as a sponsor, the National Space Society, they do ISDC. They have a space settlement seminar as well. And they're also a 501c3 nonprofit, and they have a great quarterly magazine at Astra. So check them out at nss.space.org. And ISDC is at the end of May in 2020 in Frisco, Texas, a suburb of Dallas. And Celestis sponsors us. And Celestis is still the iconic pioneer for Memorial Spaceflight Services. And they have flights where you can send the ashes of your loved one or DNA to suborbital, orbital, the moon, and soon they'll be beyond lunar opportunities. It's really great service and very moving. As I said before, I've done it three different times. And I have my mom and dog pending, dogs, plural, pending their next lunar flight, and hopefully that will be soon. So if you want more information, go to Celestis.com. And you can also add your DNA to that of your loved one's ashes or DNA and symbolically make the trip with them. The Integrated Space Plan sponsors us, and this is a highly detailed development chart showing the path to becoming a spacefaring race. You can see how technologies and destinations build upon one another. Explore hundreds of individual elements in more detail at thespaceplan.com. And you can buy your own copy of the Space Plan. It comes in two different kinds and sizes. And all of this is available at their website, thespaceplan.com. Makes great stocking stuffers and space gifts for your favorite space cadet, space enthusiast, space advocate. And listeners, one more time, we are in our annual campaign funding the space show for 2020. If you like programs like the one we're discussing with Morgan Irons today, please support us so that we can continue doing this on a very regular basis in the coming year. And PayPal is up at the top of the space show pages. And please use PayPal if you want to write a check. It's the One Giant Leap Foundation, and you mail it to Box 95, Tiburon, California. And we're into part two. Our guest today, Morgan Irons. Morgan, are you still with us?
Yes, I am here.
Thank you. I have two emails, and then I'll give you Bryce's second question, which is more thought-provoking than probably his first one. So Bijan, as I like to refer to him, his name, if I can say it right, is actually Bjorn. He's in Sweden. What about skipping traditional agriculture altogether and instead use something like Quorn, Q-U-O-R-N, to produce food in space? Quorn being available in food shops today and since decades being a microprotein produced in closed cisterns using the biological processes of some microbial fungus. What do you think?
Yeah, Quorn. I don't know if I've ever heard of that before, actually. So it's a microorganism. Correct me if I'm wrong. It sounds like it's a microorganism-based product.
I don't know because I, too, Bjorn, am not familiar with it. But as we talk, it's Q-U-O-R-N. So it's all over Google, so it must exist, right? So you can use it for meatless products, chickenless products, turkey. I mean, it's a meat substitute product originating in the United Kingdom and sold primarily in Europe. Aha! Bjorn, now we know why you know about it and we don't know about it. It's because it's sold in Europe and Sweden is in proximity to Europe. But it is also available in 18 other countries. It is sold as both a cooking ingredient and as the meat substitute used in a range of prepackaged meats. Now, this is from Wikipedia, so I urge everybody to take that with a grain of salt. But that's the extent of what I know about it.
Mm-hmm.
There is a Quorn website for here in the U.S. Whatever fantastic flavors and textures you want to experience, Quorn has a great selection of products that will help you make mouth-watering. And then I have to go to another website. So I guess you can't really respond to his question because you're not that familiar with it. But it doesn't sound like it offers all of the food security type of elements that humans would need to flourish. I mean, I'm guessing at that. So I don't know. I'm going to defer to you.
Yeah, well, it definitely is an option. I've heard of products that are based on using microorganisms and how you can use microorganisms as a food source to create these alternative products. So I think it is definitely an option that we need to consider because the more options that we have that we can potentially put into an integrated system, I believe that would just be the better. I mentioned briefly about this concept of food security, and you also just mentioned it about how, like, the things that we are considering, ultimately, we have to understand how they fit into this need for food security. And food security, you are pretty much talking about going off of the definition that the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations use. They say that food security is a situation that exists when all people at all times have physical, social, and economic access to sufficient, safe, and nutritious food that meets their dietary needs and food preferences for an active and healthy life. And that's the definition from the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations. So whatever we're considering, we have to take into account, is this food source going to be easily available? Is it present in production? Do we have food reserves? Is there a market for it? Do we have to transport the food, or is it in a local garden right there next to your habitation? As well as considering access to it, Do your crew members, does your household have sufficient access to this food source? And then you also have to consider the utilization of it. Is this food source having, does it have adequate nutrition and energy, and is it being utilized to the maximum extent? So this goes into understanding the dietary and cultural preferences for food, which will be very important when we are considering who we're sending to Mars. So if people are completely lose their appetite thinking about eating a fungus, well, what can we say? I definitely have no qualms with that. But you have to consider the food restrictions and the ability for people to eat certain kinds of food. And then ultimately, all of this, when it comes to food security, you have to ask the question of stability. Will your food system, with its different components, including a potential microorganism-based diet, will that allow your system to be food secure at all times, no matter the changing environment, no matter the economics surrounding it or the political factors involved with space exploration? So very interesting to consider.
So going back to Bjorn's question, he wants to skip agriculture altogether and go to the use of corn. So I'm taking from your answer that nobody would skip agriculture altogether, but corn might be an element of solution and product in how agriculture is used and mm-hmm. developed in space. And I think it would be very hard to skip it altogether because how do I say it? The traditional regulatory and health and nutritional areas are all wedded to agriculture, so to just dump all of that for one product or for one approach, I can't see science going in that direction.
Yeah, and you also have to consider that you will have to be able to grow the fungus or the microorganisms that you're using. So you still have to have some ecological aspect to that. And then you also have to consider the medical and well-being and the psychological side. And this goes back into like menu fatigue. Will people be able to eat a certain kind of food for years and not get tired of it? As well as would you want to be in a highly technological space with prepackaged food, or would you like to be able to walk out into an agricultural field and see the greenery and see the growth of plants over time and have this feeling of accomplishment that you helped make this happen? So there's also that psychological and medical component that you have to consider out, like beyond just like growing the agricultural system, about how we mentally and emotionally connect with our food and our environment.
Well, I'll tell you, having spent a good portion of my 73 years on diets, and no matter how great my intentions are to live on a number of calories through lean cuisine and their packages day in and day out, I don't seem to be able to manage it for more than 7 to 10 days at a time before I throw the towel in and go back out. So there's a limit, even if you have great intentions, to living on something prepackaged and contained and not having diversity or being able to get out for the social pleasures of eating. There's no social pleasure in eating prepackaged food, except maybe, mm-hmm. maybe a Twinkie or something. But Doug has another question for you, and he's a medical doctor in Southern California. It seems to me that the ecological approach is much more complex than just the greenhouse approach for growing food, especially with an initial base. In your TEDx talk, you said that the ecological approach is better than the greenhouse because with greenhouses, you have to continually ship supplies to it. But on both the Moon and Mars, there's known resources for water, carbon, nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium. If the issue is the concern for a blight wiping out a single plant crop, then couldn't that be simply addressed by growing multiple species and seed varieties without having it without having to solve the complex problem of the relationship between species? So in the early stages, wouldn't it just be easier to start with the greenhouse approach and save the ecological approach for when we are wanting to establish biospheres?
That's a very good question. And I guess the way to start off that question is, in greenhouses here on Earth, pests are such a big problem. A greenhouse does not mean you're going to have a completely stable system. There's constant application of pesticides and the like, unless it's an organic system. Greenhouses don't mean that you're going to not have these problems of pests and diseases, even if you have a biodiversity in that space. The reason to approach it with the ecological understanding is that an ecological system has natural defenses in place to get itself out of these disturbances or to readjust itself to a new state when it goes through this disturbance. In a greenhouse, you don't have these same protections, you could say. In a greenhouse, it's a more managed, more controlled kind of system, while with an ecological system, you have more wild growth and more interactions between different microorganisms and the plants and the cycles that are happening. So the way that we eventually approach developing a system, an agroecological system on Mars, there will definitely be steps that need to be taken. And that's where I initially was talking about an integrated system, where you might start off with a hydroponic system, and you could potentially also have a greenhouse kind of setup. But ultimately, when it comes to having that stability and that resilience and that ability to adjust and adapt to disturbances, whether it's a disease or a pest, you have a solar flare or anything really, that would eventually like lead to potential plant death and a situation like that, it's better to have an ecological system that can readjust itself, because ecological systems are always adjusting themselves. They're never in an equilibrium state. So that's why I tend to approach this as us needing, for the long term, we need this quasi-closed agroecological system approach. But definitely, the steps that we take to get there, it definitely needs to be an integrated system where we have different stages and components while we're developing the system. And it's very important to do this research here on Earth before we, or and on the International Space Station or even on the Moon, before we have people living full-time for years on another planet like Mars.
So, but going back to Doug's question, he's asking a very simple question on the surface, mm-hmm. and probably a more cost-effective question, although he didn't mention costs, to start out, to jump-start, say, 4, 5, 6 people, whatever, living on the mm-hmm. moon. Wouldn't it be better to start with the greenhouse and, you know, like crawl before you walk and learn and evolve into the ecological method? So could you, or would you want to start ecological from ground zero?
Yeah, I would say I would agree with him that it would be easier to start off with a greenhouse kind of setup and use that as a way to support yourselves while you're developing the agroecological system. And there's just, you always have to consider the risks. And you'll have risks with your agroecological system as well, but you also have to consider the risks for a greenhouse as well. So I would say that it's a great option to consider in the research. And I would probably say that, especially if you have people living on Mars before your agroecological system has been developed or started, having a greenhouse would be a great option to help supplement or support your system.
Okay. Listeners, we'd love to take your phone calls other than just emails. But you already know that, don't you? And you still choose emails. The phone is 1-866-687-7223. You can, with much disappointment, continue to use email, Dr. Space, DRSPACE, at thespaceshow.com. So, Bryce, in his discussion, was talking about recycling everything, including human waste, and
yes.
And he's really into the recycling human waste and talked about that a lot. So he said, "I should ask you." So that, again, these are his exact words, not mine. Ask Morgan how she would use poop in her ecological system.
Yeah, oh my goodness. That's a good question, because my idea of its use has changed over time as I've learned more. And like the initial talks that I gave on this topic as an undergraduate have definitely evolved with my ideas and gaining more knowledge. So when it comes to using poop, or another word that is used in the agricultural industry as a biosolid. The thing you have to consider with biosolids is their source. So with using biosolids on Mars, they're not going to be necessarily mixed in with, like, industry chemicals and stuff like that with your water treatment facility. So what you're looking at on Mars is more coming directly from humans. And with that, you have to consider what is found in these biosolids. So is somebody taking a medication? Is somebody taking a hormone pill? Is the food that you're eating... does it have a chemical composition in it that will translate into your biosolids, things like that. So as well as, like, if you have a microorganism in your gut that transfers to your biosolids, how will that affect your system as well? So you have to consider what's in your biosolids, as well as the steps you have to take to process those biosolids, whether you put them through a sterilization process or different processes. And it gets very complicated here on Earth with our water treatment facilities, but it would probably be less complicated on Mars. So I would say it's... It's definitely an option that needs to be looked into further, because most of the research that's been done here on Earth looks at biosolids from water treatment facilities that also take in industrial sludge. And so there's that concern when these biosolids are applied to agricultural fields. It's like, what heavy metals are going into our soil and thus into our plants? So... I would say that more research needs to be done when it comes to using biosolids where humans are the primary source, because I don't have enough knowledge about that. I would say that if you're using biosolids that have an industrial source where heavy metals are being used, I would be hesitant to use biosolids. But when it comes to humans, like I said, more research needs to be done, because it would definitely be a good fertilizer source Are you going to have like medications and stuff?
Yeah, so I hear all the time, I read these studies where, and especially since I live in San Francisco, they say it all flows into the bay and into the Pacific Ocean. All of the vitamins that people take are mostly wasted and are passed out of our body. It's all marketing crap for the most part. And then they can tell the antibiotics that we're taking because most of that gets passed through. And, you know, the water supply gets tobramycin in it, gets this in it, gets that in it. So, and apparently, well, I guess they're not processing the biosolids for any kind of nutrition. So, they're not trying to get any of this stuff out, but it goes and then gets back into the food supply through fish in the ocean or, you know, fertilizer or whatever they're using it for. So, is it even economical to try to get all this stuff out so that you had biosolids that had a pure nutritional base? I mean, maybe your population is more controlled in space and the fact that you can't go to the drugstore and buy every kind of vitamin and supplement known to mankind to cure every kind of imaginary illness you have. But, you know, would it be easier to control the human input than it is here on Earth? And so maybe it's not as big a deal in space as it is on Earth?
I agree that we need to recycle as much as possible and use it for the function and the resources that we can get from it. And I think we have a better shot of using biosolids in space if humans are the only source. But again, yeah, we need to do the research to look at the effect, because even if you have humans on the crew, they're on Mars who aren't taking any medication, is there still residue in their systems from when they were back on Earth and took the medication that's still being transferred out? So I would say that this is an open field of research for anyone who really wants to look at this question of, if we're just using human biosolids, what's the difference between a human taking medication and a human not taking medication? The time period, if a human takes medication and then stops taking it, how long does it take for that medication to no longer have a presence in the biosolids? It would be a fascinating study, I would think.
And I'm assuming it's not been done, or you're not aware of it, or?
I am currently not aware of any studies that have focused on solely human biosolids as a potential fertilizer. There might be a paper out there that I just don't know about, but so, my current knowledge, I'm not sure.
So to kind of summarize a response to the question, Bri, you think there probably are applications for using poop, but there's so many unknown, unanswered questions about using it, the source of it, what's in it, that how you use it for the best and highest purpose in space is unknown at this time.
Yes, more research, I believe, needs to be done to make it a safer option.
Okay. What do you do in the spaceship going out to Mars for 6 or 8 months or something like that? Are you just living off of supplies that have mostly been loaded on before you launched from Earth? Or are you able to substantially supplement or take over food for the crew while you're in transit?
Yeah, so with that kind of situation, of course, it probably not be viable to load up a bunch of soil onto your craft, because that goes into load costs and then the amount of space that would take up. So you would probably have a lot of prepackaged food, but also something like the veggie system that's on the International Space Station. Actually, something that I can mention right now is that myself and my collaborators, who I will mention in a moment, for my research, we just submitted a proposal to help develop a new food growing system on the International Space Station. And that's through the ROS Bio RFP that NASA put out. And I believe it's Appendix C that particular one was for. And we developed this new design for a new system that has a biochar-based growing media. And we got past phase one approval, and now we're submitted our proposal for phase two. And so we'll see, like, with that kind of system that could potentially be used in transit. And just to mention quickly, there are a lot of people who are sponsoring and supporting my research. Of course, my PhD advisor, Dr. Johannes Lehmann, here at Cornell University, is very supportive of all the work that we're doing on this. And then I also have collaborators at Florida Institute of Technology, Dr. Palmer, Dr. Wheeler, and Dr. Batchelor, as well as Free University in Berlin with Dr. Rillig. And then we also have Dr. Barnhart at the University of Southern California. And then my research is also being supported by corporate sponsors, which include Bio365, which is a commercial biochar soil company here in Ithaca, New York, as well as my own company, Deep Space Ecology, is also supporting. And we also are working very closely with Rhodium Scientific to send our samples and experiments up the International Space Station. And all of my research also is currently being supported through a fellowship that I have with the Norfolk Institute, which is a nonprofit organization that's focused on the research in human resiliency when it comes to enabling human life on Earth and in space.
So does this mean all these sponsors really want to see space settlement? Could one infer that from your list of sponsors?
Yes, they are all very much supportive of getting us into space and doing the research, as well as looking at how the space research can inform Earth applications as well. And it's wonderful to have all the mentorship and support of these various individuals and organizations and collaborators, because when I first started off on this amazing journey, I felt like I was the only one at times, because I tended to be the only ecologist or soil scientist or environmental scientist in the room at a lot of these conferences. But now, through spreading these research ideas and spreading this message of how we can approach habitation on places outside of Earth, there are people who have definitely stepped out and contacted me and are excited and really want to see this move forward. And I would love to talk with more people who are interested in this topic, so that we can really have this open communication and this exchange of knowledge, so that we can find these viable, sustainable solutions to these questions that we're asking.
You have an email. I know we're coming up on the end of 90 minutes. Jess is in Tucson, and he says, have you ever entered into a dialogue, or has anyone from SpaceX ever contacted you?
I have never. So I do know people who work at SpaceX, because I'm also part of the Brooke Owens Fellowship Program. I'm a 2017 fellow from the Brooke Owens Fellowship. And so I know fellow women who have interned at SpaceX, and one of their main people, I'm blanking on her name, she is also a mentor with the Brooke Owens Fellowship Program. Apologies, I can't remember. but nobody has physically called me or emailed me from SpaceX asking me any questions about this.
And you haven't volunteered your services?
Not yet, but maybe. We'll see. We've been, these past years since Space Ecology was founded in the May of 2016. We've been doing, as any startup does, a lot of shifting, a lot of reevaluating, a lot of research to really understand the state of the research and the science and the industry to see how we can best meet the needs and the future needs of the industry.
Do you have any timelines in mind on how you see this field and outcomes progressing?
I feel like in the next 10 years, we are going to see more people, especially more young people, asking these questions and entering this field. It's actually pretty amazing. The amount of emails and messages on social media I receive every month about students who are starting off on their academic career or even still in middle school and high school who are like, I read about what you're doing and I've never considered this, but it actually is something that I want to do with my life. And so please like provide me mentorship or provide me with like some answers to some questions that I have. And just seeing that gives me hope that as the new generation comes forward, that we will actually start seeing more engineers, more scientists, more artistic and outward-looking people asking these questions and actually helping to find solutions to these questions. So on the student side of things, I believe that we're about to see more people entering into this area of study.
Is there anything we should have talked about today or have left out or somehow omitted through ignorance that we should at least touch on before we close down the program for the day? Or is there anything else that you would like to bring up and make sure we know or give us a talking point or a takeaway?
Yes. I guess I can give three takeaways, and these are actually the same takeaways that I had in my Space Studies Institute conference talk. At the very end of my talk, I give three takeaways, and I believe that they still apply to what we've been talking about during this program. So the first takeaway is that Earth agriculture and space agriculture have very similar challenges in the realms of extreme environment exposure, human needs, food security, looking at isolated communities, and soil and agricultural management. So just seeing these opportunities and these connections, this should really open up the ability to have cross-industry collaboration in research and business and academics. So that's my first takeaway, is that there's a lot of opportunity for multidisciplinary work and open conversations on this. And then my second takeaway is that when we are developing these agroecological systems that ultimately need to allow for human and ecosystem adaptability and resilience, we need to understand that these systems do not only provide food and should not only provide food to your crew. And this goes into considering the other ecological services that they provide, whether it's ecological services that support the biogeochemical cycles of the soil or provide medicinal and cultural elements and the like. So we need to get out of our heads that agricultural systems and agroecological systems only provide food, because that's not the case. And then my third takeaway is that we really, really, really need to address the sustainable development and management of space agricultural systems and develop this methodology of how we would approach this so that we don't repeat the same mistakes that we've made with agricultural systems here on Earth. And a lot of the movement that I'm seeing in the agricultural industry today is this movement back towards embracing the traditional knowledges of local peoples around the world, because a lot of their practices were very sustainable. And so how can we take these traditional knowledges and practices in a respectful manner and bring them forward into the modern day to create more sustainable systems? And then how can we translate that to creating a sustainable manage system on the Moon, Mars, and beyond.
Fabulous. So maybe we'll have Native American food settlement supply and management on Mars coming from the western part of the United States.
Yeah, you never know.
With the Native Americans. Interesting. Morgan, I hope we can stay in touch with you, and as more things develop or you write additional papers or you have new creative ideas and solutions, I'd love to bring you back on the show and talk to you some more.
Definitely. I would very much enjoy that.
Do you have a kind of a newsletter or anything where people can follow your work if they want to?
So people can connect with me over social media, of course, which I've provided all the links to you.
Right.
We also have the Deep Space Ecology website as well as the Norfolk Institute website. We're developing newsletters to be sent out so you can get updates on the research that's being done.
Okay.
Through those as well. But if you want, like, the day-to-day, in the moment, like, this is what's happening, I usually post every day to my social media about what's happening in the lab or what's happening with deep space ecology.
Okay. And listeners, that should be on the blog. If you have any trouble with any of the links or finding anything, please let me know, and I can put you in touch with Morgan as well. Thank you again for doing a terrific job of teaching and being with us on the space show. We really appreciate it. Also, a great holidays to you and your family and New Year's. And we will look forward to having more input with you as this field develops and we push towards a space settlement on the Moon, Mars, and who knows where. But it's exciting, that's for sure. You have an exciting field that you're working with.
Yes, and I look forward to sharing more about it and seeing more people collaborating on this and coming forward in the industry. And thank you so much for inviting me to be on the show, David.
Okay, well, it's great meeting you. I'm sure we'll talk again. So, listeners, that's it for today. And come back for our science fiction films Persephone and Saturn V with Future Dude on Sunday at 12 noon. Goodbye from Morgan, David, and the Space Show. Everybody have a great weekend. Keep looking up and be safe. Again, goodbye from the Space Show.